Exploit Roundtable.
Bonus episode.
Hello and welcome to a year-end bonus episode of Reality Exploit Roundtable. My name is Voodoo and I'm joined today by Wise Guy, Smuggler, and Plato from the regular Roundtable. We're going to shake things up a bit today. Instead of our usual four topics, we're going to do some end-of-year cleaning up by taking a bunch of topics that we just haven't gotten around to on regular Roundtable episodes. While we're doing that, we thought it'd be a good time to introduce our digital production assistant. As time's gone on, we've tried to automate more and more of the Roundtable production, and we've dubbed the collection of scripts and programs that we use Taboo. So the first thing we're going to change going forward is a timer on topics to try and keep us on schedule so that we can get consistent episode lengths. Why don't you tell us about that timer, Taboo?
When the moderator asks the first question, a timer will start. When half of the time allotted for that topic has elapsed, you will hear this tone. When the entire time has elapsed, you will hear this.
Yeah, and we're not rule followers, so God knows if we'll even pay attention to that, but that sounds good. All right, Taboo, you might as well take the moderator role today if you want. Take it away.
Okay, let's start with some recaps. Plato, in episode 14 you talked about free cities in Honduras, but the Supreme Court ruled them unconstitutional.
Yep, that's right. However, the thing is that in Honduras, the core structure in the government is kind of skewed up. It's unclear whether this project is going to go on or not, and at least it's raised the discussion of creating territorial zones that are autonomous and have their own legal structures and stuff. I do encourage you guys to go and look at our show notes in episode 14 and read through the thread of comments on one of the original blog posts, because there's a lot of great discussion in there from residents and people in the government, and it's worth checking out.
I don't understand how they made this, said this was unconstitutional. This was done as a constitutional amendment in the first place. So, obviously I don't understand the legal system in Honduras, but if you make a constitutional amendment, doesn't that by definition?
I think they never did. I think they wrote the amendment and somebody prematurely said, hey, we're amending it. It's going to be good. And then they didn't pass the amendment. I think that's what happened.
Interesting. I was under the impression that it had already passed as a constitutional amendment, and that then the Supreme Court came back and said, nope, it's not constitutional, which sounded like a break of tautology to me or something.
Well, I guess we are crap at researching our topics. Sorry, audience.
Well, the thing is that essentially the Constitutional Court can test if an amendment will be in the line and in the spirit of the rest of the Constitution. So there are higher parts of the Constitution and lower parts of the Constitution.
Perfect. Thanks, Smuggler.
Smuggler, despite our advice to students in Houston to hack their school ID, one student got suspended for refusing to wear it. What do you have to say to the rest of the students?
That they are cowards, and that they're not participating in that protest is horrific. I mean, please, you're turned into an asset, just numbered and treated like anything. I mean, please, stand up against it and join the ranks of Andrea and whoever is with her, and simply stop obeying those control freaks.
Yeah, I'd go back to what we originally said is, there's a lot of games to be played with these RFID chips, and it's kind of disappointing that I'm not hearing any games being played with them already.
Yeah, that's truly sad. I mean, it seems that they're just going along, and that is really bad.
Well, isn't that the whole point of school?
Yeah, but change that. Listen to Reality Exploit Roundtable. We give good advice for protest, and just follow us.
Yeah, but we're degenerates.
Well, not the worst people on the planet, I guess. We're not making people wear RFID chips, do we?
Wise guy?
Yeah, we are.
Well, the value in RFID chips is that they're very, very good at helping track things that move. Unfortunately, then people figured out that, hey, they're also good at tracking the things that make things move, which would be people, and that's where the problem is to me.
Well, I think that something similar is happening in the banking industry, where the transactions using RFID and now near-field communications in the PIN cards are definitely being used to go well beyond anything that's needed to prevent fraud, but actually providing databases about what people are doing with their money and where, you know, and making any kind of privacy more and more difficult.
But Weisgott, you're blowing their cover. That is the story behind it. Of course, it's not about fraud or making us safe. Of course, it is about tracking us and controlling us, nothing else.
Absolutely.
Voodoo, you have said that dogs are just dowsing rods for probable cause. But some UC Santa Barbara researchers are doing something novel in mechanical explosives detection. Take a listen.
Dogs are the gold standard for explosives detection as well as detection of vapors from illicit substances. And what we're able to do is develop a machine based upon microfluidics and nanotechnology that can sense with the same quality and performance that a dog, and in some instances even better than a dog.
It's better than dogs at explosives detection. So doesn't that sound better to you?
Yeah, not so much. It's funny that their gold standard for explosive detection has not been subjected to a double-blind trial. These are just dowsing rods. So far, any track record that I've seen of a sniffing dog has been just barely better than chance. So yes, they have better noses than humans, but you know, they're not superhuman. They're not some sort of mythical creature that can sniff out things that these people aren't saying. And if these mechanical chips are as good as and maybe sometimes better than dogs, well, then they need to be subjected to double-blind trials too. But having said all that, it's they're doing something novel here, which is, you know, the air that they're passing through these little tubes, they're concentrating on the sides of these tubes less than the width of a human hair, and then sampling that, which, you know, might end up with some good results. But then they need to show that in between samples that they're sufficiently clearing out those channels and that they're not getting residue in that. And I didn't see anything about that from these researchers.
I wonder how well they can handle multiple combined smells, and does that screw up the test?
Well, the gold standard for sniffing things out is, of course, the bee, the common honeybee, which is much better and less distracted than dogs are. But what this reminds me of is a project that the Stasi had, the East German intelligence service. And what they did, they collected smell samples of people so they could track and find those people later. So I wonder when we will have police running around and tracking people by their smell.
I've got a smell they can track.
Wise guy, in a previous episode we talked about ride-sharing applications like Lyft and Sidecar. Did you hear about Uber being accused of price gouging after Hurricane Sandy?
Well, yes. The taxi business is the typical rent-seeking guild. They pitch themselves as good for the public, but nothing can be further from the truth. As Alan Greenspan once remarked, regulation favors the regulated. By using taxi commissions and other regulators, taxi operators have prevented any meaningful competition in their industry from the beginning. And by the way, I'd like to say that I knew this for a long time because my grandfather was a taxi driver. Uber should not have backed down during Sandy. Sure, they might have gotten a black eye in the press, but their economics was right on, and it was certainly as it certainly was, and their ability to supply cars would have made a double impact on consumers. Not only would their system work, but they'd show that their economics operated behind the scenes to make it work. So Uber-type services are great opportunities for the longtime unemployed who still have good credit and are judgment-proof. Just rent the vehicles from an agency like Hertz and Dollar. Cars are near new, mileage is typically unlimited, and you can get good weekly and weekend rates. If you have a platinum card, they provide insurance for free, though I'm not sure if the card or rental insurance will cover for-hire situations. But if not, it's a great opportunity for insurers. The insurance risk is mainly to the passenger, as the driver is judgment proof. They have little fear in a civil lawsuit.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. It was they were actually showing how by raising the rates right after Hurricane Sandy, they were actually bringing cars into places where people needed transportation. And yet, you know, they get accused of price gouging. So they said, okay, fine, well, we won't raise the rates. And then the cars disappeared. So, I mean, it was proof positive there of the economics.
This is why there's farm supports in most countries, most notably in the European Union, because if people are exposed to the free market, they get really upset when they have to pay what the going cost and rate should be with a reasonable profit margin by the people in that business. So instead, the governments tax the people, steal their money, pay it to the people who are having these price supports, and then the people can buy the product like milk, for example, or cheese at some unrealistically low price and feel that everything is working. Maybe the taxi driver organizations should do the same thing and go to the government and get paid by them. Then they could lower the taxi rates and people would think things are great.
I think I'm getting the hang of this. Let's move on to
drone warfare.
Smuggler. In September, S Media placed posters depicting the NYPD shooting at kids from drones at bus stops. Here's why.
The meaning of the drone campaign? Well, for me, it's really about creating a conversation. We've obviously seen a little bit of press in the last year due to street signs that I was involved with about the possibility of the NYPD authorizing drones to fly in the skies domestically. And I don't think the conversation has reached a mainstream level where we are like talking about this at the dinner table and whether we want this to take place. We have to remember that these are devices that right now internationally are being used to kill people. They're armed, they shoot missiles. We're fighting an illegal war in Pakistan and nobody seems to want to talk about what we're bombing people left and right. I think we should be talking about whether that's technology we want to bring to this country.
Apparently the NYPD didn't want the conversation. In November, they arrested Desim and charged him with 56 counts of possessing a forged instrument and possession of an unloaded 22. Why are they so afraid of a conversation?
Well, I don't think that they're afraid of the conversation. The only thing they're really pissed off with is the protocol of conversation. Because people, listen, the way the government wants to convert with you, to talk with you, is they say something, you listen.
Yeah, very true. This was, but they're just, you know, proving his point about the overhanded or overreaching tactics of the NYPD when they arrest him for making a political point like this.
Yeah, but he wasn't licensed to make any point.
Plato, according to an AP poll, only 36% of Americans surveyed are opposed or strongly opposed to police use of unmanned drones. Why is this number so low?
Two possible reasons. One is that 64% of Americans thinks it's a great idea. Another likely one is that the poll methodology is producing a low number. I think it depends a lot on who you ask. Certainly, you know, all of us panelists are pretty concerned about putting drones in our skies. I can't really add much to what Esom said in our last answer because this is some dangerous technology, powerful technology, and it's really easy to go wrong with it. And, you know, plus the majority of the media that gets out in America is not showing, you know, drone strikes in Pakistan. It is a forbidden topic.
Well, I think that most people are supporting these things because they don't think that it's going to affect their lives in any negative way. In the same way that people don't think that their mobile communications, which is tracking them all the time and all of the breadcrumbs that they're leaving about their life activities, aren't going to somehow come back, like, for instance, in a divorce or some other situation and screw them big time. But they don't think about it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Right, and there are lots of people that actually believe in the government system, the legal system, to actually work and do what's good. And So for drones or for Trojans or whatever, it's all the same. They say, you know what? We have a system. We have separation of powers. This will work. It won't be that bad. So they trust the system and the technology will screw them.
Yeah. And by the time the system evolves into something ridiculous, it's damn near impossible to get rid of it.
Well, the other thing is that, of course, the people evolve into something ridiculous at the same time.
And I'd go back to what Smuggler said just in episode 15, that drones are sexy. And if the police can make a good case, you know, putting more helicopters in the sky and putting police on the streets are sexy, too. And they get people to vote for those all the time. They'll vote for, you know, tax increases to pay for drones, too.
Voodoo. After the U.S. election, it came out that Obama was worried about entrusting Mitt Romney with a kill list. Why doesn't Obama trust democracy?
I'd say he doesn't trust democracy for the same reason none of the rest of us should trust democracy. Here, this is a question that should be out of bounds of a democracy. You don't ask, should a president be entrusted with a kill list? You ask, on how in you know, anything, the name of anything that's holy, does anyone end up with a kill list? It just proved that democracy fails if you can't restrain the democracy from and asking questions like that, as far as I'm concerned.
I think it actually shows that democracy has succeeded. Democracy is basically the ability for the majority to decide what rights anyone should have and what's legal, whether or not there's any natural law behind it. So it's okay if it's for people to entrust powers that they don't have, such as the ability to imprison someone privately or to murder someone. It's okay when enough people vote something that someone else can do it. It's okay?
Yeah, I guess by the logic of democracy, kill lists are a good thing.
Well, whenever you ask someone, they say democracy is such a great thing, and you say, well, okay, so what if the majority votes to kill you? You know, and they shut right down. Well, no, that would never happen. Well, in this case, that's exactly what's happening. Of course, you know, now that Obama is reelected, he's slowing down on the, you know, the administration slowing down on making these rules for how they can use a kill list, because, you know, like Eric Holder says, you're just guaranteed due process by the Constitution, and we've determined that due process is Obama figuring out whether you should die or not.
I actually think that it's not so much about Obama not trusting Romney. I think the point behind it is really that Obama wanted to show that he's a considerate person that works according to some kind of system that there is in America, and that he's not arbitrarily killing people, but that he has some kind of rule for it. And I think he just wanted to demonstrate that so that he wouldn't be indicted afterwards if he lost the election.
That could be, but that would have been a point to make before the election, not after the election.
Well, true.
Well, there's still time to indict him.
All right. Time for some of the econ and finance stories we just didn't get to. Plato. A study by Dorit Ron and Ajish Amir found that 78% of bitcoins remained under the control of the persons who mined them. What will happen to the bitcoin economy when those coins are unleashed?
Well, there will be more bitcoin circulating. And it'll be basically a Bitcoin quantitative easing. I mean, you know, not that there's some guy in the middle who's saying release the Bitcoins, but some participant in the economy is saying, you know what, I want to spend these now, I want to cash out. And he dumps, you know, 100,000 Bitcoins, or, you know, in the case of the biggest accounts, like a million Bitcoins into the economy. And there's going to be more money chasing the same amount of products, which is likely to drive prices down. At least at first, and that includes the cost of each Bitcoin, and that's likely to get more people to start participating, because if they see cheap Bitcoins, they might get scared and say, oh shit, Bitcoin's failing, or they might say, oh nice, cheap Bitcoins, I can invest more. So, you know, I don't know what'll happen, but we'll see.
It really depends on what economic theory you're following. I mean, if you're a good old Keynesian or monetarist, this will be awesomely good for the Bitcoin economy. I mean, just print more money, higher liquidity, everything is good, we'll all be rich. Or, as I believe, it will just, you know, fix the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody knows, at least now after that paper's been published, everybody knows that those Bitcoins are sitting there and they could be unleashed at any time. I'm sure that's priced in.
Well, I doubt it.
Yeah, likely.
No, most markets are very poor about pricing in risk. I mean, just before the beginning of World War I, UK bonds were trading at premiums that indicated that there was no risk for war.
You know, I got to throw in one tiny stat I saw on Zero Hedge, and that's simply that out of the $600 trillion worth of derivatives that are owned by like the big players in the derivative markets, there's only $600 billion of collateral banking all those debts, and they're all bets in this giant mesh against each other. So if AIG fails again and people can't pay off the collateral on these debts, it's going to end up in a giant chain where nobody gets their money from all these derivatives. So I think it's, it kind of has a parallel with the Bitcoins because it's a bunch of wealth that's stored in this little segment of the economy that might disappear.
They can get a Bitcoin bailout.
Yes, a financial circle jerk.
Voodoo. Among the stupid ideas for not falling off or cushioning the fiscal cliff is a proposal to mint $1 trillion platinum coins. If you are going to salvage change from your couch, it might as well be worth your while, right?
Yeah, I don't know why they're going to stop at trillion-dollar coins. I would go ahead and make it even quadrillion, and then we can all take the next 200 years off or something. It's, you know, it's just a silly proposal, just as Smuggler was just saying with the Keynesian utopia. Monetarists are just as capable of this, and if you just print enough money, you can solve any problem. And that's all this is. It's just somebody spitballing, saying, oh, you know, we could pay it off with two... Congress decides how much coins are worth, they could just pay off all the debt, and of course it's not going to work.
Actually, when I read this the first time, I thought to myself, hey, this shouldn't be in the Washington Post. This is a release by the Comedy Central.
Yeah, that's about right.
Wise guy. Mexico has banned large cash transactions, including limiting currency exchange to $1,500 per month. Have similar bans on the use of cash produced any results, or is this just a continuation of the war on anonymity?
That was for a wise guy.
Oh, sorry. Clearly it's all about monitoring financial transactions and people's movements. There's no doubt that the limitation of financial transactions to a certain amount doesn't work, because it just goes into the underground economy. In the same way the war on drugs has failed to end drug trade, in fact, quite the contrary, there's no doubt that people will decide, hey, this is bullshit, and I'm going to do with my money whatever I want.
Well, the other point is not just the war against anonymity, but it's actually forcing people to use the systems that are controlled by the state, so that the state can manipulate what you're doing in those systems. So it's not just about gathering more information; it's also about manipulating how people act. People are forced into using the banking system, into using official systems. And whenever they're all in there, then you can use those systems to apply whatever pressure you want to the population.
I think also that those systems have a large enough market share, mostly by denying competition, that it gives them some advantages in the marketplace that wouldn't exist if people had the options to choose alternate currencies.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's the point of having a new method of enforcement. I mean, the term for that is soft tyranny, as I recall correctly, And that is, you want people to be nudged into the one or the other direction by making them offers or denying them offers. And you can only do that if you have them in a system that you control. So next time you're refusing to take the RFID chip under the skin or whatever, well, your rates might drop or rise or whatever.
Ha 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 ha
How about some stories of evil people being evil? Smuggler. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission is reportedly close to a settlement with Google over what they are calling antitrust violations. Do you prominently display your competitors' advice on shadowlife.cc?
Well, if my competitors would pay me handsomely for that, I might do that. But of course, I mean, what is the position and the point of the FTC telling Google what to do? I mean, please, screw you. If you are against Google and against fixing the search results, start your own search engine or stop complaining.
Yeah, like the I forget which Google exec, but his quote was, our competition is just a click away.
Well, isn't something like this, a parallel like this happening in Germany with ads for newspapers and the ability to have Google have headlines that point to the magazines themselves and the newspapers?
No.
Oh, okay. I'm off chart then.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me. That your search is fine, and you're the number one search, and we understand that you've got a significant market share because of the search. But what we want you to do is we want you to prioritize your competitors' results in your search over your own results. And you know, if Google was seriously prioritizing their own stuff and it made it a less effective search, then the competition would come in and have a better search. You know, other search engines provide other sorts of services than Google does.
I read recently that the color pink makes people think of like emasculation and weakness. So perhaps Google can just simply put pink backgrounds on like the Bing results and the Yahoo results and display theirs in like a blue background.
Awesome idea.
I like it.
Plato. ISPs in the U.S. have announced plans to begin enforcing the so-called Six Strikes Plan in 2013. What advice can you give to people who want to keep internet access this year?
Start being a lot more careful about your torrents. If you're, you know, legitimately downloading Linux distros, that's fine. But it looks like the ISPs are going to start probably using some deep packet inspection to take a look at the content that's going through the pipes to your computer. And if it looks like the torrent for a known copyrighted thing, they'll give you a strike. And as you accumulate strikes, you may have to take some remediation courses, re-education, or I don't know, perhaps pay fines. I'm not really clear on the punishments. I'm not sure if they're only looking at BitTorrent. You could try purchasing Usenet access from one of the many providers who accept Bitcoins. If you want more security, you can always purchase VPN access. Again, you should go with somebody who accepts Bitcoin so you're not giving away your identity through your payment information. Torrent Freak has a good article about how to make your VPN secure, and that's linked in our show notes. You can try going through a VPN as well as Tor, but it'll be very slow if you want to download stuff. I would go with the Usenet first if it seems that they're only looking at torrents.
Especially,
go ahead.
I was going to say that especially using satellite access to Usenet, since it's unidirectional and no one knows what you're actually sampling.
Well, the other thing that you should be looking at for your file sharing joys is ITP. ITP is actually a pretty anonymous network that is not bad when it comes to torrent. It's more or less built in. So I'd look at ITP and sharing my files there.
And of course, I misremember the name, but just small local networks of personal friends and acquaintances who you're sharing files with in a closed network.
Right, friend to friend and darknets. Actually, if you're really smart, go ahead and put a network attached storage on a Wi-Fi and put it in some cafe in your neighborhood and make it server to your neighborhood to share files.
Nice.
Great idea.
Voodoo. The Department of Homeland Security wants to set up a group of weekend keyboard warriors as a reserve to be called up in case of cyber emergency. Have you filled out your cyber draft card?
Yeah, I'm not too keen on filling out anything for the government. But this is very strange to me. First of all, I'm not sure what would constitute a cyber emergency that would require calling up a bunch of, you know, reserve keyboard warriors. You know, it seems if your technicians, if your computer guys aren't in place when an incident happens, calling them up would be too late. You know, if they just want to do, you know, telepresence and have everybody working from remote locations, depending on what the emergency is, if you're talking a DDoS situation or something like that, you could make it worse by having people try and access the server remotely. So I'm not sure exactly what this is supposed to do, but there's a very simple solution. Open source software. They would already have a reserve component there that does it automatically, that audits the software and looks for security holes.
Well, maybe the whole point is to have a bigger view on who's able to do those things, while at the same time not having to pay them all. So I think the standard reserve for the military, the cyber reserve, is more or less a bookkeeping game to help the government finding out who's available on the market and then draft them if they're needed.
Maybe we could have the cyber reserve youth corps.
Hey, the Stuxnet virus and a couple others that are attacking these industrial control systems that are used to control valves and stuff. Anyone know if there's an open source set of firmware for any of those?
Yes, there was recently an open source SCADA firmware release. I forgot the name, but it's just this or last week.
Nice. I imagine that it has a lot better security than the stuff provided by, you know, the main Siemens, all these big guys.
It's not hard to.
This is shitty.
It's not hard to beat Siemens on security.
Smuggler. Researchers from the University of North Carolina, University of Wisconsin, and RSA published a paper detailing a side channel attack that recovered a private key from one virtual machine from another virtual machine. Given that all enterprises of any size are or have moved to virtualized environments, how concerned should businesses be about this attack?
What the attack really shows is that there's no replacement for physical security and physical separation. So it's not enough from a security standpoint to move all your stuff on virtual machines in the cloud. Virtual machines are a great management device, but they are not really tested and understood when it comes to security issues. So instead of cutting down all your expenses and virtualizing everything, please make sure that your core systems, those that have the keys, are still physically separate from other operations. That is just good advice and should never be forgotten, even in the wake of cloud and virtualization.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first heard of virtualization technology, my first question was, okay, so how do you isolate the virtual machines from each other? Or, you know, what guarantee do you have that the virtual machines are isolated from each other? And the, you know, Citrix and VMware, their answer back is, well, they are. They're just isolated. Well, how do I know? Because we say so. They are. And, you know, I hate to say it, but you know, because it goes against the grain of virtualization in the first place. But you're absolutely right, Smuggler. The machines that have these keys need to be on physically separated hypervisors, A, and B, until they can figure out some way to keep them from, you know, getting any sort of side channel information. I think they're going to have to assign dedicated memory from each of the hypervisor to the virtual machine itself and not have that memory be available for the other virtual machines.
I think that the best thing really is that people should be looking into using more HSM, hardware security modules, that do both the key management and the public key part of hybrid encryption schemes, so that the long living asymmetric private keys are not released to the machine ever, so you cannot lose them ever. And HSM modules are pretty cheap today. I mean, they come for less than $500. And if your business is worth anything, invest in that.
Plato. Scottsdale Inventions has patented handcuffs that can deliver shocks or inject restrained persons with drugs by remote control. Besides the obvious BDSM implications, how excited are cops about these?
Oh, I imagine they're quite excited because I think probably the biggest fear of a cop is getting hurt by some violent individual. And, you know, regardless of whether the cop's usually the one initiating violence, but if they can have a tool to keep the guy subdued in time for their buddy to get there, it'll probably save a few lives. Of course, it's eventually going to be tossed on guys in the drunk tank and in, like, stone kids who the officer has a grudge against. And it reminds me of Rita, the prostitute in Idiocracy, and she's trying to get some Carl's Jr. at a little street side vending machine. And it gets stuck, and she, like, bangs the machine, and it squirts out a puff of, like, gas to calm her down. So I can see it devolving into a crazy situation like that.
Well, another great thing about those handcuffs is, number one, you have a new obedience tool. You know, someone, you know, saying something you don't like, you know, shock him, drug him, whatever. The other thing is, it's great to create evidence. I mean, imagine you're picking someone up from the street as a policeman, and you don't know what to charge him with. Very easy. Press the inject some heroin button, and you have a heroin addict that you picked up from the street. Hey, that's awesome. I mean, it fixes the whole system.
Wow. Yep, that was my thought first, too. Of course, the other thing is that the remotes on these are going to have to be paired with the handcuffs somehow. But if, you know, almost by definition, it's going to have multiple remotes for that will pair with a pair of handcuffs at any given time. So that's going to make that easy to clone. And so you just, you know, you roll up as a cop watcher or whatever, and as soon as you see somebody put into the cuffs, you hit your own remote and give them a little jolt just for grins, I guess.
Well, I can actually see in front of my internal eye that there are policemen sitting in the back of the car with their own handcuffs on and drugging themselves instead of facing reality.
Yeah, it was just a case of an accidental discharge. I don't know what happened. It just went off.
He said accidental discharge.
And if it's done in the evening, is it a nocturnal emission?
Yay.
Voodoo. Chinese ISPs are using deep packet inspection to learn, discover, and block VPN access from within China. How easy would it be to implement a scheme like this in North America or Europe?
Well, actually, Plato's already answered this. The ISPs are probably going to start doing this right away anyway. Politically, I don't know whether they'll be able to stop VPN access from within the country or within the continents, or even, you know, if you combine North America and Europe, whether they'll stop VPN access within. But certainly for external networks, that would be an easy thing to do for the ISPs to implement and probably politically viable. Within those areas, you know, too many businesses are relying on VPNs now. I don't think they'd get it on.
Well, the thing is, of course, the Chinese businesses rely on VPNs as well. I mean, I think that the whole argument that the government won't do some censorship technology because it will hurt business has been proven wrong by this instance. And DPI is a growing industry. I mean, there are more and more networks that are getting DPI appliances installed on. And the whole thing with DPI is actually that it gives a whole new class of power. I always heard the argument that you cannot block this or prevent this because you would have to shut down the whole internet. With DPI, you don't. With DPI, you have a system that can target specific types of protocols, networks, and destinations. So you can actually whitelist some VPNs that businesses need and blacklist and automatically find VPNs that the resistance is using. And you can do the same thing with Bitcoin. You can do the same thing with BitTorrent and so on and so on. So we're moving into an age where you don't have to shut down the internet anymore to block some evil protocol, but instead you program a few DPIs that actually learn themselves.
Wise guy, UK government has begun monitoring the online habits of jobless persons. Participation in the program is voluntary, but the sanctions for non-compliance are mandatory. What are some alternatives to a program like this?
Well, it's a good thing that government benefit programs are starting to look at trying to weed out slackers people using their benefits to avoid any work and stay on the dole. But the whole aspect of unemployment as being involuntary as far as deductions on your payroll is a non-starter for me. It would seem to me that a better alternative is for people to look at ways of working off the books and self-insuring unless and until some commercial unemployment insurance schemes are available that work with that. Insurers would quickly figure out how to reduce costs, eliminate fraud, perhaps using similar methods as are now being proposed in the UK.
Yeah, that's what I actually fear about that, though, Wise Guy, is it if you self-insure, if you buy yourself unemployment insurance, first of all, the premiums are insane, and if you can even get a policy. But second, why wouldn't these companies jump on board with whatever program the government's putting together just to save themselves the payouts?
Well, the solution for any kind of unemployment insurance is, of course, that you never ever want to have the people in the workforce anymore, but put them into some kind of a coffin where they're internally and eternally entertained and not raise any costs anymore.
Are you saying we're in the Matrix, Smuggler?
I think that the Matrix is exactly the solution some of the tyrants want.
Are there no workhouses? Are there no debtor prisons?
Do these in the debtor prisons, if people are working off, wherever reason they're in the do the people who are actually owed the debt actually get that money, or does all the money go to the state?
I think that some of it went back to the original lenders. By the way, during that period in Victorian England, it was a golden age because they used these methods to essentially eliminate the lower classes. And so they moved up the bottom end of the socioeconomic rungs. That's why they were exporting people to Australia, things like that. It was just a horrible time from a human rights standpoint. But from an economic standpoint, it was a golden age in England.
Now for some of my favorite stories in tech news. Smuggler, Jeremy Gosney was able to build a rig with 25 GPUs and demonstrate an ability to churn through 348 billion password hashes per second. What should this tell anyone about password management?
Well, there's one real easy lesson here, and that is never use a password twice. Never use the same password on different websites. Have good passwords on every password, on every website, and have an extremely good, like a DiceWare password on your password manager. There is nothing like trusting and relying on a single password that you distribute widely, as everybody with half a brain can understand.
Well, and then there's the other side as webmasters, and people developing applications, you have to be conscious of how you're storing passwords also, make sure they're salted and hashed appropriately and not reuse that salt.
Well, the thing actually with this attack, with this machine, is that we're not talking about simply hashed passwords anymore. Yes, most sites today have a good salt management. It's one salt per account, and they hash their passwords. But with this machine, we're actually talking about simple hashing algorithms being non-effective anymore. What we're talking about today is that you need to use stuff like gcrypt or similar that uses thousands or millions of iterations of a hash algorithm or a hash algorithm that is very memory hungry to make those attacks more expensive.
So is there any practical solution for the little guy?
The little guy should never use a password on a website twice. That is the practical solution.
And have something like PasswordSafe or some other password manager that has good hygiene in order to protect their passwords?
Exactly. Have a good password manager that you use locally and make sure that the password that you use on the password manager is really secure. So we're talking about something like a DiceWare password or something that is really long, really random, very hard to deduct, and that even a machine like this will have several decades to crunch at.
And of course, if somebody can make one of these sitting in his garage, I guess he's doing Bitcoin mining too, by the way, with 25 GPUs. That's kind of cool. But if he can do it, then the NSA's already had this capability for a long time.
Well, the NSA is for sure using ASIC systems for that are even, well, they're magnitudes faster than this.
Wise guy. Ross George dumped 100 tons of iron sulfate into the Pacific Ocean to produce a plankton bloom and lock carbon to the bottom of the ocean. Is this the eco-terrorism we've been told to expect?
No, I think bioengineering is not on the front page, first in food production and now in ocean engineering. These large-scale experiments, I think, are necessary to discover if they can safely be used to sequester CO2 or encourage better food production and better ocean management. You know, people, the UN is complaining about these as being illegal, but they have no problem, apparently, with countries overfishing and destroying entire species. So it's bullshit is what I call on it. So, you know, these guys actually seem to have good intentions and not just a means of making money out of this technology.
Well, the point they're really criticized for is that they're making money of it. If they would have never sold any carbon shares for this experiment, the UN would applaud them and fund them. But no, this was private initiative, and that is not allowed to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly what I found funny about it, was that Canada didn't actually have any laws on the books that would stop them from doing this, but the scientists and everybody were up in arms because this guy was doing it as a private venture, for-profit venture, instead of taking taxpayer money to do it. If he would have taken taxpayer money, they would have had no problem with it whatsoever. But let's move this to a higher plane and say, we just need to have property rights on the ocean, and you can stop things like this.
Well, that's the problem with the commons anyway, in every aspect, isn't it?
Exactly. You could at least get compensated for, you know, if someone did something like this and damaged your property on the ocean, you could get compensated for it. In this case, you know, I guess the jury's still out whether it did good or bad. Because other scientists have done these same experiments, just not quite this big, and using taxpayer money. So it's tough to tell whether it was good or bad, but if you got harmed and you had property rights on the ocean, you could actually get paid for it.
Plato. Danger Room has linked the disappearance of 36 communications technicians to the Zetas cartel building a radio network in northern Mexico. How is the cartel making an uneconomic arrangement like slavery work?
Slavery is perfectly economic if you're a Zeta, because you're getting labor for free. They're able to do it because they've captured the government, and there's no rule of law in Mexico that says people who kidnap guys will be punished. Since they're able to take the technicians without repercussions, they have no disincentive to do it, so they'll keep doing it until it's no longer economic for them to steal communications technicians. If there's a government in place that's actively, you know, shooting the kidnappers and, like, restoring some order, or, you know, any other structure that manages to make that happen, they're going to have to start paying for the communications technicians, because they'll, you know, be shot if they just take them.
Well, I don't understand in the first place. You know, they're, say they did, and I'm not convinced actually that they did take these technicians, you know, because no trace has been seen of these technicians. People that get abducted, they end up being, you know, killed or held up for ransom, or they show up someplace. This is 4 years these guys have been gone, and they're not showing back up. But let's say they did. They're going to have to feed them, clothe them, keep them alive all this time. This is skilled labor that it just doesn't make sense that they could have a slavery arrangement like this, to me, economically, as opposed to just paying. You know, they have the money to pay for people who would have, you know, the incentive then to actually build them a robust communications network.
Maybe this is just a plausible deniability operation for the technicians. So essentially, the technicians sold themselves to CETA, and they just want to make sure that nobody will be taking them to responsibility over building that network.
I'm really surprised that the Zeta networks haven't gone in and provided some kind of prizes or financial encouragement for the creation and commercial deployment of software-defined radios that would permit them to do, you know, low probability of intercept communications. Depending on Raytheon and those companies who will provide backdoors into your system won't work. So you need to have some open source, open hardware design systems. I haven't seen anything like that, but it seems to be a natural movement. If I was in the Zeta cartel, I would be doing that.
Well, number one, maybe they have, and we just haven't seen that yet because they're keeping their mouths shut about it and don't look for the additional reputation they could get. Most of the cartels, not so much from Mexico, but Colombia, have been well known for employing top-notch scientists to do their bidding and being paid very well or shot. And the other thing, in my opinion, is that CETA doesn't have to go all that way, and they're not really that smart most of the time, because CETA and most of the others down there are not in the business of being smart, but in the business of being most violent.
Smuggler. It appears that Google will be introducing a physical payment card to augment their Google Wallet app. How secure will this arrangement be?
That is very hard to say. There's so little information out there about what they're doing and not doing. It could be very safe. It could be very, very bad in security sense. But one of the things that needs to be said about it is that it's probably a privacy disaster. Essentially, what Google wants to do is they want to get a hold on all the physical payment systems as well. They want to make sure that they don't have only your search history and not only your phone usage with their Android phones, but they also want to make sure that they see it every time you're buying ice cream somewhere on the street.
Yeah, now you've got two things to keep track of when you got Google Wallet. You got that the card itself, and then in your phone that's got the NFC, or the Google Wallet's using the NFC on. You got to keep them both secure, physical security on both of them. Hopefully you can keep them together at all times.
Well, the thing that will happen, or is actually happening today, is that NFC-enabled payment cards are already used to track people or to steal credit card information. So essentially, if you can go close enough to an NFC-enabled credit card or something in that technical arena, you can use your own phone to copy the credit card numbers minus the CVV number. So that is actually used already to identify people, to track people, and to steal from people. And I'm not so sure where this is going. It might become a rather big disaster.
All right, well, that was a bunch of topics, and in a flurry there. We went really quickly through them, but I suppose we can see why they never actually made it to a full Reality Exploit Roundtable episode, because they were kind of short little topics that we only had a few things to say about. But thanks to Smuggler from ShadowLife.cc, Plato, you can find him as The Real Plato on Reddit and Twitter. Wise Guy, we're not sure where you find him. We just schedule and he shows up somehow. I run an agorist, a directory of agorist businesses at blackandyellowpages.com. If you want to list your business on Black and Yellow Pages, send me an email, voodoo@blackandyellowpages.com, and I will send you an invite. You can find show notes on all the topics we discussed at agoristradio.com, and we thank Hero, who wasn't with us today, but we thank him for hosting us on agoristradio.com, and you can also find previous episodes of Reality Exploit Roundtable. Thank you for listening, and Happy New Year.